of this, we should just extend what we talked about before, like in men's work, you and I have talked about the boy, the man, and the god. We talked about the girl, the woman, and the goddess. We should just extend that and say there are four stages, to be honest about it. And we need to work on that because this ties into the three utopias, you see, in a funny way. Because if you have the four different transcendent stages, well, it's not transcendent when you're there, but it's transcendent when you're not there yet. So the child has a transcendent fantasy of becoming an adult.
Yeah.
The adult is in a transcendent fantasy of becoming the sage. The sage is a transcendent fantasy of becoming God, meaning you, if you really achieve something in life, you're lucky. You are one of the forefathers or urmoters or whatever that become divine for others later. You become a relic, a holy relic or something. So that chain has to work. That means there's no direct access to God anywhere unless you get to the very top. And that means that anything else is indirect. You have to respect that. That's just the name of the game. That's the way it works. That's the way it works for you biologically. That's the way it works in us historically. That's the way it works almost cosmologically. But if you don't say cosmologically, at least humanly. So it works that way. It's no matter logically the right order. And if you try to jump...
So you can't skip any steps, obviously.
No. And if you want to ignore the steps altogether, you end up with the idea that a newborn child is the God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Christianity had that already with the God in, you know, in the Virgin Mary and the Jesus child. Wait a second. This is eerie, right? Yeah. We got it wrong from the very beginning. Yeah. Because wisdom is divine, not innocence. So the will to transcendence need to be tied to phallic vision. That's where phallus comes into the picture. And that means without the direct access to the divine, that means the third utopia after ecotopianism and cosmopolitanism, they are obvious. Ecotopianism is the planet itself, the context, the container, okay? So that saved the fucking planet because otherwise we have nowhere to go. The Garden of God. It's the basement. In the container, you put humanity that are now intertwined with one another, 8 billion people going towards 10 billion. And I don't want them to be 2 billion because I don't want to have concentration camps and mass extinction. I do want people to be allowed to be 10 billion if they want to. I want them to be allowed to be 10 billion for the next 20 to 30,000 years. So that's ecotopianism for you. And that's also cosmopolitanism. And that's where we need the machines. We need the machines to help us save the planet. We need the machines to help us contain the bomb. And we need the machines to help us love the stranger. Now, all these three ambitions are within those two utopias. If you work them out fully. The city of God is an old concept. The city of God is like a society of people who live next to the stranger peacefully and can make that work. And the inspiration for that are ritual places and trading posts throughout history. And they're way stronger than nations or national borders. They have membranes instead of thick borders around them. We can learn tons of shit from that. And I think learning about the Silk Route and when it worked, and at least we avoided the pandemics, it worked. Like that's the shit we need to learn and relearn today and have as a model for society. It's called cosmopolitanism. Derrida, Levinas, Critchley, they've all written about it extensively. The work's been done already. But these two utopias already have been worked on. We recognized environmentalists. We bowed to them and said, yeah, thank you for pointing this out 40 years ago that we were going down the drain unless we watched this. And I deeply admire Greenpeace, but Greenpeace is a dystopian sect. And if their message is going to be widespread, it's not going to take Greta to do it. It's going to take ecotopian vision that is reliable, full of new technologies and some sockers and everything to make the planet work for 20, 30,000 years. Now, that's a vision the young engineers love. Okay. But the third one is the Tower of God. And here comes the bad news, or the tough news. Zizek's new book is called Sex and the Failed Absolute. Now, if you really want to be Hegelian and go beyond Zizek's failure that he's obsessed with, you would be honest enough to say Sex and the Closed Absolute.
What do you mean?
Tower of God, the Tower of God is closed to humans. He must be. Because it's the future of the future. You cannot be there. That's exactly why in mysticism, you can walk into the most sacred room in the temple. You cannot walk into the most sacred room.
The holy of the holiest or whatever.
The holy of the holiest, exactly.
Yeah, that's
Jewish
right.
Mystic.
You can't go there.
In Zoroastrianism, this is why Judaism is so interesting here, because Judaism and Zoroastrianism have this in common. It's lacking in Islam, it's lacking in Christianity, because they're sort of much more infantile, populist religions with great missionary zeal, the big religions. So they're not very sophisticated. To be honest, about Christianity and Islam, it's lacking in sophistication, where Zoroastrianism and Judaism are much more powerful. Mm-hmm. And that is because when you go to those two religions, you see that they have a strong mystical tradition. That means there are three religions here. There's a matrical religion focusing on the mother and the child, the delivery station. That's fundamental. There's a phallic religion for men to go out in the world and conquer and come back with abundance. Phallic religion. But there's the third religion, and the third religion is the priestly religion. Hmm. And that's for you not to see. And what is striking about it is that this is the big break with where the internet's been heading so far. The internet essentially said, you must expose absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the ultimate superego. You must expose absolutely everything to be anybody here, and it will be remembered forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the internet is like a huge pornographic camera staring straight into your soul, demanding everything of you, and for it to be thrown out in public and torn apart.
Mm.
That's the internet.
Mm-hmm.
There's only way to respond to that superego. And that's to say, I won't tell you anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to close the door. And you're not getting it.
So this is about intimacy. This is like creating intimate places, private places, secret places.
Yeah.
Places
for each one of us, the way we mimic the priest, the way we learn from the priest, because individualism is also sort of a distorted mimicking of the shamans, because shamans are perfectly fine living on their own in the forest. The rest of us can't handle that. The rest of us must be inside the tribe, right? So we mimic the shamans all the time, and sometimes we go wrong, we do it because we shouldn't. But if you want to mimic the shamans here, it's precisely when the shamans tell us, there's a closed door here, you cannot go inside of it. The Tower of God is the utopia you will not hear about, because your sons will, but you will not.
Yeah. But that's great, because then there's no finality, then there's no closure, then there's no, you keep going forever, right?
Brilliant. And this is Zoroastrianism at its core. The priests have their own religion called Zoroastrianism. We know for a fact that even there was no text, there was no narrative, no recorded record, no record left afterwards. That's typical for sacred religion. And the mystical religion called Zoroastrianism, we know that they worship something called Zoroastrian, and Zoroastrian is essentially kind of hyper time, below all of space and time and materia and the universe as we know it, which exactly where physics is heading, by the way, sort of sub-physics. Hypertime is there. It's called Zurvan, and it's a gender-neutral god that couldn't care fuck about us humans.
Mm-hmm.
Only priests can handle that kind of a god. Mm-hmm. Only priests have such a tough psyche to be able to handle that.
Yeah. Humans. I've met a few,
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what's required of you to be a priest. That's why... You know, take something like drug policy. Why we get lost with drug policy all the time in the debate on legalization or criminalization, all that, because we don't understand that in any civilized culture where you use psychedelics, for example, like Shikibo do in Peru and Colombia, you have three different divisions. You don't talk about criminalization or legalization. You say these are very strong, potent medicines that should be used for sacred activities. They're not to be in public. They're not to be thrown around. That's criminalized. But you leave them within religious organizations where recognized priests who have achieved a certain status and recognized by the priest are allowed to serve them to you when they think it's fit.
Yeah. So they're not some kind of junk, you know.
The way we go to a doctor.
Transcendent junk or whatever.
The way we go to a doctor to get some kind of a license to get a certain medication. Yeah. That's actually brilliant, because the doctors are also remnants of the priesthood. So the priesthood is trusted to handle those very things that are dangerous for the rest of us, because the priest can experiment on it. Nobody cares about that. Yeah. They don't have children anyway. They don't have any, you know, they're out there on their own. But the priests come in and say, we have the psyche to handle this. You can't, but you have to come to us to do it. But the sacred room, in a way, in Zoroastrianism, it is the difference between Horvatat and Ameritat. Problem with these translations is the Harvatat be translated as perfection, Ameritas be translated immortality. It's so damn wrong. Plato only popped up about 1200 years after Zoroaster. There was no such concept as perfection, immortality. And the Iranians did not build pyramids. They obviously did not care about an afterlife. Neither did the Buddhists. So if you look at it from that perspective, then you realize the Harvatat This is Sanskrit and Avesta. Heart of Atat means ever refreshing renewal. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like flow, right? Not so much you feel flow, but it's similar to flow, but it's much more extended and much larger. It's like you're in a state of constant creativity, what we call synthios. You're in that state, right? Mm-hmm. That's Heart of Atat. But it has a goal, a direction where it's heading, and that's called Amiratat. And Amiratat should be properly translated, not immortality, should be translated as the idea that survives you. In other words, your heritage. Mm-hmm. That means the Tower of God.
Well, that's the real afterlife. It's after your life. It's not the afterlife.
Exactly.
You call it's like it your children and everything else is the...
It's called the Shinavat Bridge in Zoroastrianism. Mm-hmm. And there's no talk about any other country or the other side. You just leave, cross the bridge. You then become an immortal to the mortals. You become a forefather. You become a forefather mm-hmm. or a urmother. And what the Zoroastrians do, they celebrate your memory for the next 70 years. Every day, the day you died. The Paul Gazar is a celebration in Zoroastrianism of the day you died for the next 70 years. Mm-hmm. They send your corpse off to the vultures, but they celebrate your memory every day for the next 70 years because they would love you, if they love you, to be one of the forefathers or one of the urmoders, and that's what you potentially could become. That is how you become immortal to the mortals. It's not immortality for you. That's a Platonist.
So that's interesting because that's like, you know, most early religions have ancestor worship in some form or another. And so in a way, it's not worshiping your ancestors. It is worshiping your ancestors in a way that you're trying to go, you're trying to also find that in a different form or.
Yeah, the ancestors are ahead of you and they're behind you. The ancestors are behind you and protect you and they'll also push you and challenge you to move forward. The ancestors are ahead of you and they try to seduce you and pull you to go in their direction. This is the phallus and the matrix. This is magical.
Oh, I like that idea.
Ancestors are ahead of you. So this is religion. This is no matter. This is the fundament of religion. And all sound religion has that. Hinduism has it too. India could really contain itself because the phallus in India is, of course, Shiva. In Shaivism, it's, of course, phallic military religion. And Sikhism is another version of... Sikhism is very Zoroastrian. It's like Zoroastrian take on Hindu thinking as well. The Sikhs and the Parsis get along wonderfully well in India. They understand each other perfectly. The Sikhs basically have a monopoly on the military in India, and the Parsis take care of the trade. So they're very successful phallic cultures in India, and that speaks volumes, right? And so the phallic is where we're going to go next, and when vision is lacking, that's what's really, really what you're all looking for, right? And then you got the matriarch and the matrix coming from behind. So that sort of
seems like the matriarchy is more democratic and the phallic is more somehow elitist or something.
Yeah.
You know, if
I got the question
saying that the Zoroastrian is a phallic religion, it's kind of an elitist religion, and Judaism also, and Christianity and Buddhism are sort of universalist kind of religion.
We got this other great friend from the States called Justin Murphy. Justin Murphy is this great guy. He's creating an amazing new network for young independent intellectuals called Indie Thinkers, indiethinkers.org. Check it out. We highly recommend it. Justin is wonderful.
Why is he so controversial, this guy? I don't know.
Because he's outspoken.
Okay,
right?
Okay. Just because
he's a conversation.
Direct and...
Yeah. So we have a conversation. How do you become outspoken and brave? And him and I agree, this conversation is probably going to be online any other day if it isn't already. And we say that you create a great base station. You create a great home. You have people around you that love you, support you, no matter what you do. And then you dare to go out in the open and you're not stupid about it. And then you can speak openly. So we need to teach kids, again, to speak openly, speak their minds and not be afraid of employers or friends or social justice warriors or whatever is out there. Because otherwise we will not have an intellectual discourse. Justin personifies this. He's like a great older brother for the next generation of independent thinkers in North America. And we love him to bits for it. But he and I discuss Nietzsche and Marx all the time. And one way I described it is that I have to be Nietzsche whether I like it or not, because right now, what's in Hegelian way important is to point out the need for proper and authentic phallus. And that means I'm talking to a future elite that will get this, men and women who will get this, and they will then walk to their promised land and do the Exodus. That's what we call the New Babylon. The next book I'm writing is celebrating this new class, this new elite who do this. But I expect my 25-year-old students to be Marxists, because the Marxists will then dialectically respond to my Nietzscheanism by saying that how can we widen this elite, mm-hmm. make it larger and more accessible.
Yeah, the more I talk to you, the more I kind of understand Hegelianism, I think, and why, because it's keeping both sides in this friction together.
In this friction together, you got it. Not in harmony, not in balance. That's what Taoism fails to be Hegelian. No, the Hegelian.
Well, it's like the sparks friction, of polarity friction, or something like that.
Yeah, without the friction. And when people say that Hegel didn't have will in him, or when you know Schopenhauer was pissed off with Hegel for there's nothing alive in Hegel's system, that's like ridiculous. Hegel is the ultimate process thinker. It's very much alive. His dialect is just boom like that. He's incredibly libidinal. I mean, if anybody did libido before Freud then put a name on it, it was Hegel. He's incredibly forceful. And the Hegelian attitude is the properly philosophical attitude. It doesn't go for left or right. It just understands what is needed today. For example, I would love to have a liberal conservative government next in Scandinavia, because with high tax economies and too much of a dependence on the welfare state, that's not very healthy in the long run. I want people to be more independent, and I want civil society to prosper. Okay? But I'd gladly support Elizabeth Warren in the US election.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
especially after Trump has completely made a prick of himself. Can we please just get rid of him once and for all? So, you know, if anybody goes up against a Bloomberg or Warren or a combo ticket of those two could really save the world and certainly save America. And certainly, finally, politics in America could have a positive influence on the world, because America needs a woman like Elizabeth Warren, who's a matriarch, and says, I'm going to come in with a whip and go after the wealthy, because otherwise our country will fall apart, which it will. Mm-hmm. Unless they listen to her, right? So sounds a Bloomberg Warren ticket eventually could be great. But as things are now, she's what America needs. And a Hegelian attitude is always to look at the system as a whole and just say, what do we need? It's like you're gardening. It's just like, do we need water right now? Or do we need more nutrition? Or does somebody need to go to South Africa and find some new funny plants to plant here? Or maybe we should take away the plants because we don't have water, so we plant cactus or whatever. Gardening looks at what is needed.
Context.
Yeah. The way you run a city, the ultimate form of political organization to run a city properly, the way you run a city, which is the origin of politics, is that you also look at the system as a whole. What is needed here to make the city work better? Mm-hmm. Where does it coagulate?
Yeah.
Well, where do the flows stop?
So there's a dynamic process going on the whole time instead of a Platonic model or.
And is this the city that's perfect to actually expand territorially when it grows? Or is this a city we should actually be more condensed and, you know, go higher? Well, there's no universal form for that. It depends on the circumstances. An architect is open to both. If you're an urban planner, you're open to both. That's Hegelianism for you. And that's why out of Hegel, we get Marx, we get Nietzsche, and we get Freud. We get these three amazing giant thinkers who all specialize. Marx on class analysis. Mm-hmm. Takes the old issue of justice seriously, right? And he points towards communism. Okay? Mm-hmm. Skip socialism, didn't work. Communism will work. So, and then you got Nietzsche, the Übermensch. He's the guy who's the communist on his own. But he's also too much of a Cartesian to be the answer for the future. He can only create an elite that starts, becomes the original proletariat in the Marxist sense, and who we can then follow. And then you got Freud as the last one. He's the guy who's just sitting there reminding us all, and don't be children here, because you're playing around with a very, very serious force called sexuality. It will come back to haunt you. It will always be your shadow. You'll come back to take your brain from behind at any given moment. So don't you ever think you can relax.
Who's the guy that you have Nietzsche and I just lost my train of thought. Oh yeah, you have Nietzsche and Marx, kind of, and you want to bring those two together. Who's the guy that you would put with beside Freud?
Does that make any sense? Well, you do Marx and Nietzsche.
What's the dialect of Freud?
No. The dialect is between all three of those. You're talking about power. You talk about sexuality. You talk about class. And anybody who looks like a fool, anybody who looks too infantile and too childish and too naive when they're opening their mouth about something like philosophy, they always miss out on these three. If you talk about human beings, you can't ignore class. Who the fuck do you think have you in our class? You can sit in a Californian little ring of people and listen to each other and have a great discourse. And all you need to do is Weed coming in and say, why is the Mexican cleaning lady not part of this group? And they all look pale and embarrassed. Yeah, because they don't want to talk about class. If the Mexican cleaning lady wasn't invited, she probably would have said no. She has her own better group of people to talk to. But if she had, if she wasn't even invited and she's in the house anyway, why are you pretending she's not here? Then you haven't even understood what class is. You cannot discuss anything without sexuality to begin with, because you're not serious about it unless you realize sexuality is the shadow of everything else. And also
the force. Shadow of everything else. That's a good.
And also the force on mm-hmm. which you build. It's more Tito that turns into libido when you direct it. Essentially, it is more Titanol. It becomes more Tito and self-hatred and total independent submission if you're not directed by the elders towards being libidinal and be successful. And mm-hmm. this urge to go away from more Tito towards libido is what the will to transcendence is. A child mm-hmm. who doesn't want to stay a child, who wants to become an adult, wants to have libido. An adult who's not satisfied being an adult because it's too mediocre and wants to go towards the sage state, mm-hmm. obviously strives towards libido and transcendence. And a sage who's full of libido will strive towards the divine. Not for himself, but to reach the divine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. So,
makes sense to me, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we extended the chain with the support of Favarki and Hall and their work, and now we've got four steps. And it mm-hmm. starts to make sense, doesn't it? And we've also solved the issue you and I've talked about before of the third utopia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we could say Garden of God, ecotopianism is nature. Mm-hmm. City of God, cosmopolitanism is culture.
Culture.
Yeah. And Tower of God and the closed absolute is religion.
Mm-hmm.
You got a religious utopia, you got a cultural utopia, and got a natural utopia. Mm-hmm. Now that's
where
like
does,
you, I, that I, is I, utopia for you. It's like splitting up, deconstructing God like we did in synthesis and said there's atheos, pantheos, entheos, and synthios. Those are the four aspects of God. The three first ones are obvious because they are the history of metaphysics. There's the void, atheos, potentiality. There's actuality, the universe as it exists as a whole, pantheos. And there's also the split and the multiplicity within this universe, including the God within yourself, entheos, meaning your own subject is also split, right? So you got three gods. And the fourth one we then put on top of that, it says that, well, then we can also strive towards creating God, synthios. And that idea of synthios, we now want to unify with the Tower of God in this book. And then you have the whole grand narrative is there
mm-hmm.
to do what you like with, but it certainly should inspire artists and architects.
Oh, shit. Well, I was just going
to... Engineers.
I was wondering where the artists go. Which part the artist... Is the artist in the religious realm, or is the artist in the cultural realm, or... I guess he's in all of them or in somewhere.
Well, there's a trick about the shamanoid personality.
Yeah.
The shamanic personality doesn't understand borders and has no membranes. So the shamanic personality walks freely between child, grown-up, adult, and God.
Ah, interesting.
Okay? For good or bad. That's exactly why I can put tons of psychedelics into shamanoid people and they do not freak out. They feel like they're more in the natural state when they're there. But be careful here. Only about 4% of psychology shows that people are shamanoid. Only 4% are shamanoid.
Mm-hmm.
96% of the population are not.
Yeah. So shaman is essentially the artist, essentially.
Artists, medicine men, prostitutes, executioners, diplomats, I mean, in the original sense, peacemakers who then turn into, you know, war priests when necessary. The priests, the monks, and the nuns.
Okay.
Are definitely part of that. Soldier monks too. They're shamanoid personalities, shamanic castes, as we call them in digital libido. Now, the official name for that in psychology is shamanoid personality.
Hmm.
But only 4% can handle that, have a kind of psyche to be able to handle that. You have to have a psyche that's either rock hard or you're just so loose that anything can be thrown at you and you don't mind. It's more of a feminine shamanoid personality. It's just like, no.
Oh, yeah.
I just took some drugs yesterday and saw angels and danced in the meadow. And what did you do yesterday? It's like, yeah, my right. God, if I take that amount of mushrooms yesterday, I would have blown my brain out. It's just like, but shamanoid people do not do that. They're like, and that's exactly why for them, these borders between child, adult, and God are very hard because they realize that other people actually have to have really set borders between these two differences, between these sections. It's a very, very close hierarchy. It's actually very dangerous for people to walk outside of.
Mm-hmm.
Not for the shamanoid ones. And they also do not understand things like skin color and why other people are obsessed with it. They also do not have a difference between child sexuality and adult sexuality. They don't have a latent period, for instance, between 6 and 11. They can't remember that, recall that. Just like they they cannot sexually understand the difference between child and adult.
You're speaking about yourself, I have the feeling. You are speaking about a personality, but I think you're
like that. Let's put that behind the wall that we call the closed absolute. Let's take a room and call it private. But okay, I am studying and living with shamanoid personalities. Yes.
Yeah.
As for any other activities, behind that door, it's probably legal. Those things are not Sweden, so let's just keep quiet about them and say we just do them outside of the country or whatever. But, you know, it is an interesting territory to be in. It's not for the faint-hearted, that's for sure. And I think this is the natural, logical response to the internet's current demand of us to be transparent about everything, while the internet will memorize everything forever. So we need to go against the sort of internet super ego injunction, as Zizek would have said if he wasn't technologically informed, and basically operate in a new space of freedom, which is that I'm closing my door, you can't get in here. And this is definitely what I call the Tower of God. And that's the church I will belong to, that's for sure. I will gladly inspire Ecotopians out there and cosmopolitans out there, because we need to achieve those two missions. But we will get machines to help us do it. But when it comes to Tower of God, that's not a machine's business either.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know? Yeah. The closed absolute, I think, definitely is the proper term for it. It's Hegelian. But I would go even further than Zizek and say his failed absolute actually is a closed absolute. The failed absolute is the dream of psychoanalysts to be able to expose to the analyst sound how psychoanalysis works. And even Lacan gave up on that. He never wrote anything about his successful patients or his successful analyst sounds ever. There's a point of that, because you cannot have success in the way you're cured or you understand.
Is the failure that you failed to look for a cure anymore?
I think the ultimate Hegelian take, even against Zizek himself, is to say that his failed absolute in itself is a failure. So the absolute ends up not as a failure. It is a negation. He gets it right. Sex in the Failed Absolute, highly recommended, brilliant book by Zizek. Brilliant. And by the way, read Adrian Johnston while you're at it. Another brilliant, brilliant American Zizekian. There are American Zizekians now. There's also Aaron Schuster out there. It's great, by the way. But there's got to be more of them. But the Failed Absolute should really be the closed absolute. At least that's what I'm going to call it. That's for sure. Or beyond the absolute.
Okay. Yeah.
Beyond the
so there's always a step further you can go. In other words, you're not stuck. You don't reach some final destination.
No, this is the myth of Christianity. You remember when Christ was supposed to die on the cross, the curtain that separated the sacred room and the most sacred room was supposed to have fallen, right? There was a curtain between the two. And it says literally in the New Testament that the curtain that separated the sacred room from the most sacred room fell.
Yeah.
Okay? That is Christianity's mythology, that suddenly the most sacred room will be available to all. It's like storming the temple and making all of the temple available to everybody, regardless of whether they could handle it or not.
Throw away the Torah and you...
It is, again, the celebration of the infant, the celebration of impulse, celebration of instant gratification. And this is what is tormenting us today. We are left with Christianities and Islams, both of them, promise that we can instant gratification at all times. That's a lie. And if Zoroastrianism needs to be brought back,
well, it takes away a path, doesn't it? It takes away a I don't know,
the path is reality.
Of a path, which it takes away any possibility of growth. Even
it's ridiculous. You don't in an instant suddenly get access to all the wisdom of the world. It doesn't work that way. And especially now, young people come to me all the time with their narcissism and they're dealing with it. And I tell them, you haven't read books, have you? You just jumped around on Wikipedia a few times and scrolled a bit the last 10 years? Yeah. And then looked at you and your friends' big egos and your pictures on Instagram? Okay. If that's Occupy in the future, nothing you will ever do will last more than 3 days. And it will be completely superficial and have no grounding. That's why you and I don't like Extinction Rebellion.
So we need religion.
We need proper religion. And proper religion will teach you, the first thing it will do is teach you that you take deep studies to understand this. You cannot grasp it. And it takes a lifetime of experiences. If there's anything I want to add to Favarkis' idea of wisdom, it is that it takes a whole life to live to get the kind of wisdom he's talking about. We can understand now what priests say. There's certain things you can understand now, but you have to wait until later to understand the rest here. It's deeply nomadological. It makes total sense. It's like you can learn this now. And then when you know this, we can take the next step and then you can learn this and this.
But you're at a certain age, you have some knowledge that somebody who's 10 years younger than you doesn't really have. And and you can't really transmit that to them. You can just say, you know, hang in there a little bit and it'll come to you or something.
Yeah. It's not so interesting that we're stuck inside our head as individuals. What's interesting is that the knowledge is stuck inside our head and it's hard to transmit to others. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly when we're moving to tensionalism now. It's going to be very different from capitalism because we can't trade knowledge. Mm-hmm. We can't trade knowledge. I can't get something out of my head and put it in your head instantly. Capitalism fooled us into believing that anything could be traded, but traded in an instant matter. You get what I have, I get what you have now, instantly, in exchange for money. But there are things that cannot be traded, and those are the things that are most valuable now, and that system is called attentionalism, and the algorithm will only point towards attentionalist phenomena and not towards capitalist phenomena. The algorithm will not point towards who's the cheapest. The algorithm will point towards just the best quality, has the most credibility, and does the best job. It'll point towards quality and nothing else but quality. So the algorithm will be phallic. It will create phallic order in the chaos. It's exactly what the algorithms are increasingly doing, getting smarter and smarter, and more becoming more and more phallic, more and more exact. And they point it towards your subculture, your tribal home, and the shared interests you have with others, and it points out who they are.
Sounds like the idea of judgment or something again.
Like an elderly would tell you, these are your friends. This is your tribe. This is where you belong. This is your home. This is where you got to create and create art and create a magnificent life and experiment throughout your life and create something that you can pass on to the next generation. They can then play with, right? This is Harotat, Ameritat. It's the Zoroastrian take on reality that wins at the end of the day. So there you go. So let's keep the Chinese Communist Party out of the container, the Favarkin Hollow building. Our challenge is to challenge John and Jordan to create something better than the Chinese Communist Party for a phallus, and then put our phallus into their beautiful container instead of the Chinese Communist Party container.
Right. Big cosmic sex or something.
Yeah, not Xi Jinping and his wife. Like, we don't want these kids to run the world. And that's why we love the kids in Hong Kong instead of loving Xi Jinping and his wife, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing conversation, as always.
Same here. I'm off to South America for a few weeks to work on a new book and go deeper into studies, like I recommended, and hang out with some friends, hopefully get my fat old body up on a surfboard, and be back here in the spring. Love to continue the conversation. If I get a chance from Daniel, I hope to go to Taiwan and Hong Kong and meet some hackers and see what they're up to. And maybe go to Dubai and meet some exiled Iranians there as well. What's happening in Iran too is deeply encouraging and fascinating.
Okay.
Iran and China is where it's at. If those countries could go the way of India, become open and plural, wow, how much better wouldn't the world be in that case? That's what we're hoping for. Hey, brother.
Hey.
Love these conversations.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. There you go. I love your pieces and I love the recognition you're getting sitting here with me and finally our people.
Yeah, I'm gonna keep stealing Bardisms and writing essays on them.
I am stealing the Sweeneyisms too by now. So it is definitely now a collaborative effort and I love it.
Okay.
Wonderful. All right.
Okay.
I'm off to packing. Where's the surfboard? Here we go.
Okay. Happy surfing.
All right. Speak soon.
Speak soon.
Big love.
Big love back at you.